together, and today we are very fortunate to have Lynn Reed and Jim Edge here to talk about OMAP and OHP office. Okay, thank you. So would you like to come up? And I really do appreciate your being here. Thank you. Before we have bills to eliminate the whole program, we better find out what it's about.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Reed, the Acting Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and with me is Jim Edge, the Acting Assistant Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Mm-hmm. if I understand it, some of what you'd like to hear about today relates to our pharmacy program and our reimbursement mechanisms for that program, kind of the constraints around that program in terms of the box in which we administer the program, and some of the changes that might make that a better managed program, and then to move a bit beyond that to how OMAP operates the medical assistance program in general, and some of the opportunities for change in the future as we look towards what the Oregon Health Plan might look like coming out of this session.
And don't be shy.
We won't. Thank you very much for that encouragement.
I'm sorry. part of the reason I'm saying that is because we had a very good informational overview last time concerning providers and so on, and very little direction because he wanted to be, you know, pretty neutral and all. And I was hoping that we would have people come and say, okay, this is what it is, but this is what we might do to make it better. You know, more of some direction and at least, you know, something that we can argue about or agree with or at least be aware of. So I really welcome that kind of input.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And with this, Jim is going to start off and talk about the pharmacy program.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Edge, as Lynn already said. I'm the Acting Assistant Administrator for OMAP. I'll start with a discussion of the pharmacy program and how it operates and some of the constraints it operates under and maybe some recommendations for how it could operate more efficiently. Start with just some discussion of the prescription drug program and how it operates. We have two pharmacy programs in the Oregon Health Plan. One is the managed care program and one is the fee-for-service program. The managed care program, each contracted managed care plan has its own policies and procedures for operating its prescription drug program. The fee-for-service program is a combination of true fee-for-service clients plus the mental health drugs, which are carved out from the managed care plans and paid for through the fee-for-service program. The covered drugs in the prescription drug program are all drugs unless they're excluded by CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The reason they might exclude some drugs is if the federal government has evaluated drugs and determined them to be less than effective, or if drugs do not have a contract for federal rebates, they're not drugs that are covered under the Medicaid program. OMAP requires generic substitution, and that's something that pharmacists have the legal right to do, to substitute a generic unless a provider indicates otherwise on a prescription. Drugs are paid for that are for covered conditions on the prioritized list of health services and not paid for conditions that are below the line on the prioritized list. Another aspect of covered drugs is the new preferred drug list under the practitioner-managed prescription drug program, and that program has now finished and implemented preferred drugs for four classes of drugs, soon to be expanded to 12 classes of drugs. That program, just to give a very brief overview of it, is an evidence-based process, unbiased, that reviews drugs in a particular class. There's a re-review of the program of the class every 6 months. And prescribers can indicate on the prescription and prescribe a drug other than the preferred drug. It's a very liberal process allowing them to do that. But the hope is that they will prescribe the drug that is the preferred drug in a class. Some drugs that are paid for through the Oregon Health Plan require prior authorization, and that's implemented through the Drug Utilization Review Board, and or otherwise known as the DUR Board. And that board is a group of individuals who review drugs and apply a prior authorization requirement to drugs, in some cases, to ensure appropriate drug therapy and based on medical necessity, and sometimes because there's a need to institute step therapies, to try one drug before another drug is used, and to encourage the physicians to do that. We have a contract with a pharmacy benefits manager. Often that's called a PBM. Ours is with a company called First Health. They have what's called a point-of-sale system, whereby pharmacies have online contact with First Health, and it's almost an instantaneous ability of the pharmacies to check and see if a client is an eligible client, if the drug is a covered drug, if there's prior authorization required on a drug, to see if there are any drug interactions with other drugs that a client might be on, even from another pharmacy, to determine the payment amount allowed by OMAP. They generate a download of information to our claims payment system, and that's processed on each weekend. And they have a process called retrospective drug utilization review, or often referred to as RetroDUR, and also a process called prospective drug utilization review. And those are just procedures whereby they evaluate prescribing habits and drug utilization and make recommendations to pharmacists and to physicians and to us about appropriate use of drugs and whether changes should be made. And that feeds into such things as the possible implementation of a prior authorization by the DUR board.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit more about the nature of a PBM? Is this a private organization? Is it a nonprofit organization? Could you tell me a little bit?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, a PBM is an organization. In this case, it is a private organization that assists with the efficiency and the payment of prescriptions. Most states, I think, use PBMs. Large corporations use PBMs to make their payment and oversight and overview of the payment of prescription drugs more efficient.
Now, is there any connection between is there an audit being done on this PBM? Is a PBM audited?
PBM operates under a contract with the state, and there are strict provisions in there for how they operate and when they operate and the systems that they must have in place in order to operate. I'm not familiar whether there's an audit done. Do you know, Lynn?
Mr. Chair, no, we have not audited the PBM, and that has been suggested as an area where the state ought to look to doing an audit. We're responsible for the oversight of the contract, In terms of having an outside auditor come in and look at how the PBM is performing, that has been suggested. We did check in with the Secretary of State to see whether or not they would be interested in doing such an audit, and they said no, although we could contract that out, and that's also been suggested. But given the budget situation right now, we have not done that. Our PBM is very cost efficient for us, and we believe we're getting value for the dollars.
Okay. I guess I asked that question because I've heard talk of that. I mean, and I didn't know in what connection or for what purpose, and I'm not really familiar in detail with the PBM, but now one other thing: you are going to provide some written descriptions of what you're
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do apologize that we didn't have a handout available today. We will follow up with that document.
So I don't have to take copious notes to get everything down. I can listen and make a few notes and then look at.
Yes, and next time we will bring the document
with us. Good. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Just to go on with the discussion of how the program currently operates, I'll mention that there also is a mail order program. The mail order is a more efficient way to provide prescriptions for chronic conditions and for people on maintenance medications and on long-term therapy. It's more affordable for the clients because there are no copays required, no copayments. And it's more affordable for us because we get better prices through that system. The clients also can get a 90-day supply of medication through the mail order program rather than the 30-day supply that we would normally provide through a retail pharmacy.
Okay, good. Senator Minnis.
Just a quick question on that point. Does DHR help, do they help people get into the mail order program as opposed to other programs? And if so, how do you do that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, yes, we encourage use of the mail order program for the appropriate clients, and that's primarily those clients who are on long-term drugs for chronic conditions. It's a better deal for us and a better deal for them, and we encourage
that. How do you do that? How do you encourage them?
Go ahead.
Probably the primary way we encourage that is through contact when the clients call us and ask us for information through our hotlines, through our client advocate service units, and we have an opportunity to discuss it with the clients. We also have done mail-outs to clients about the availability of the mail order program.
And we're simply informing them that it exists.
We recently switched to a new mail order contract after a process of putting that out for bid and getting the best price, and did a mail out to all clients after that contract was in place in January.
If I could add to that, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis. In addition, we've done in the last couple of months some significant education activities with our field staff, and with the implementation of copays in the pharmacy program, we've made the field staff have been very engaged in terms of working with their clients because I'm probably ahead of you here, but the, for someone using the mail order pharmacy, there is not a copay associated with that. So there's a benefit to the client, and all the information we've sent out related to copays, we have shared the mail order information with clients.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, just for the committee, to me it's interesting because I do take one of those long-term kind of medications for my arthritis, and you know, you get this from your health insurance provider, it's not just Oregon Health Plan, and they have these brief instructions about how you can do it, but I'm talking about a pain in the neck. Because not only do you get a prescription, because, you know, I call my physician now and say, would you please, you know, reorder my prescription or refill the prescription, and here's the pharmacy that I use. And they do that either by fax or however they ultimately. But with the mail order program, you have to have a physical copy of a prescription of some sort, which your physicians are generally willing to do, and then mail those off to the mail order house. And I guess what I'm suggesting here is there a better way to do that? By facilitating the obtaining of the prescription, if one exists for these long-term, and then facilitating the implementation of the mail order process, as opposed to just leaving it. I mean, I've often wondered why my own insurance company, if they know that it's going to potentially save them money, why they wouldn't, you know, help develop a way for me to, I guess, direct my physician to a number and, you know, do it via mail order, as opposed to me having to handle a number of papers and make that transaction occur.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, once a client signs up as a mail order client, there's a single page form to fill out and send in. Then after that, the physician indeed, it doesn't have to be done each time, and the physician can fax, for example, a prescription directly to the mail order firm.
Cross Blue Shield that has this problem.
We'll look to make sure that we're taking advantage, though, of all all those efficiencies that might make it easier for our clients to access the system. This is a new venture for us in terms of it being a primary objective.
Last session, or maybe it was even in 99, one of the representatives' wife had a real concern with only getting a 30-day supply of a particular drug when they were traveling and whatever, and so there was a long discussion. And the mail order thing came up, but what prohibits more than a 30-day supply of a medication at a drugstore and allows it a 90-day supply by a mail order house? I don't understand that. Is there...
Mr. Chair, that is completely a state policy choice. We could have a longer period in retail.
And there was a bill to do that, but I don't think it passed. But anyway, in other words, we're buying these drugs out of state, and if you buy them out of state, you can get them for however long you want, or, well, 90 days. So where is this mail order house that we buy from? Or are there several?
Mr. Chair, it's a new contract. It's with an in-state vendor, Well Partner. And it's a single vendor.
But they're in-state.
That's my understanding now. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jim.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure where they're located. Well, we can find out for you.
I'm curious about aren't they bound by the 30-day rule if it's in Oregon?
The 30-day rule is set up by the department. It applies to the retail pharmacy, and our contract with the mail order vendor allows for a 90-day supply, and that's also done in rural. And so, indeed, there is the option to the state to change its rules.
And Mr. Chair, there's a balance we need to maintain between allowing too much drug to be purchased at a time when a drug might be changed, when a drug might be discontinued, and then there's a waste of drug. And that's why we've set the 30-day limit on the retail pharmacies.
I remember that argument because they were concerned about water quality of drugs not being used or flushed down the toilet or something. And so I mean that. Thank you for reminding me.
There are
a variety of reasons why you may not. Well, you would want a shorter. Except, I take a particular prescription that I will always take. It's a blood pressure thing, and I have to keep ordering it. And I'm running out right now as we speak. And if I have an attack while we have this meeting, then I'm in trouble. No, but I mean, to me, it would make sense if I could get a longer supply. The rules are.
Mr. Chair, I will just say that one of the directives that we heard in the last legislative session was that we should encourage the use of mail order and alternative methods of delivering.
My Safeway pharmacist is not going to like that.
Well, yes, sir. And this is one of those mechanisms that does encourage the use of mail order. It is a lower reimbursement to the state or a lower cost to the state. And so this is one of the things we've done to encourage that use.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I've got three questions. Number one, what kind of control do you have to assure that a drug that's prescribed is actually one which pertains to a covered process or covered ailment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
Well, in other words, if I've got hemorrhoids and the doctor would normally order preparation H and you get one for preparation J, you checking out to see what preparation J is for?
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher.
Which might be for something that wasn't covered.
For a non-covered condition, we have recently implemented a rule in DHS that requires the physician to indicate on the prescription if it's for a condition that's below the line on the prioritized list. And we are making an attempt not to pay for drugs for conditions which are below the line on the prioritized list. That has been something that's been a bit of a problem in the past. There have been some drugs that have slipped through for conditions below the line on the list, and we're trying not to allow that to happen.
That's what I wondered if. Can you say recently? How recently?
You know the date when that rule was put into place? It's been within the last year.
I believe it was in August. And that's in terms of requiring the physician or the prescriber to indicate that this particular script is for a non-covered condition. We, earlier than that, however, did put in place some prior authorization requirements for drugs that are primarily used for below-the-line services. So in that case, if a script comes in and processes through the PBM for one of those drugs, there would be an opportunity to have an interaction and find out what the condition is, and a decision made then as this drug being prescribed for a covered condition or a non-covered condition. And we're looking at expanding that some more to make sure that we're not paying for prescriptions for uncovered conditions.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, there have been some who have suggested that we put the actual diagnosis, or require the physician to put the actual diagnosis on the prescription, and then there would be no doubt at all whether something is for a covered condition or not. That has met with some resistance from the physicians especially, who would prefer not to do that, but it is a suggestion that has been made, and the compromise that was reached was to require the physician to indicate on the prescription if it's for a below-the-line diagnosis.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Fisher. What can you give us some comparison when you're talking about these 90-day drug and mail order situations and so forth, which to me pose some definite problems. I have a sister that orders by mail order, and she's not on the Oregon Health Plan, so she's got every right to do whatever she wants to do. About half the time she's bugging her local pharmacist for a week's supply to get her by until the thing gets there, and because she either forgot to do it, or it got tangled up in the mail, or she's traveling someplace and somebody didn't get the mail forwarded in time, and one miserable excuse after another. But what kind of studies have you done to actually see how much you save by the 3-month prescription over what you'd get if you were authorizing a 3-month prescription or a 90-day prescription locally? And again, why should somebody, just because they're not maybe able or some way or another to get the 90-day prescription by the mail order, why should they be impinged upon and have to mess around doing 3 times the work to get their prescriptions that somebody else has to do? Because my feeling is that if you got a 90-day prescription at your local pharmacist, you'd also get a little better rate than you get on a 30-day.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, that is definitely a compromise position that was reached to put the 90-day supply in the mail order program and the 30-day supply in the community pharmacy program, primarily because the longer-term drugs tend to be better supplied through mail order, and short-term drugs and antibiotics and things that are not long-term tend to be more appropriate through the community pharmacy. We have not done studies on it yet because this new enhanced mail order program only began recently, and it'll take a little bit of collection of data before we see the exact savings from that. To go back to an early question that you asked when you first started your questions, the mail order programs generally allow a physician to write a 30-day prescription or a 90-day prescription to be refilled 4 times for up to a year, and then a mail order vendor can set up a process whereby it will automatically mail a new supply every 90 days if a patient will work with the mail order supplier and do that. So I would think in the case of your sister, she should be able to set up that kind of a process.
Okay. Senator Minnis?
I'm just wondering why we wouldn't allow the physician to decide up to 90 days when they write a prescription. I mean, for instance, if my rheumatologist says, because that person is doing my treatment, says you're going to be, at least my expectation is you're going to be on this drug for at least the next 90 days, or, then why not have them put up to a maximum 90 days? And I don't know if I took that to my local pharmacy, if that would save, you know, my health care provider, insurance company, any money at all, whether there could be a discount.
Mr. Chair, to save at least two prescription writings.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, and senators, actually, even in the community pharmacy program, it does allow the physician to write for 90 days or a year, up to a year, in terms of the duration of the prescription and authorized refills. It's just that when the prescription is dispensed, we will only pay for 30 days at a time. So that does require someone to go back to the community pharmacy in order to get the next month's supply. It doesn't require the physician to do additional work, however.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How many physicians could you save if you weren't having to pay those every 30 days instead of just once every 90 days?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I think that that is indeed a part of what we'll be looking at and evaluating as we move in further in terms of a greater use of the mail order program. I don't know the answer to that today. The decision was made several years ago that it was more cost effective to limit it to a 30-day period, but I don't have the data on which that decision was made.
I remember this more and more, the meeting that we had last year or 2 years ago, and there were compelling reasons given why it should be limited to 30 days, and some of them had to do with the type of drug and whether or not it was going to be used, and if it was a drug that you they wanted to see if there was going to be a reaction to it, so they gave you a smaller amount so they wouldn't have to end up throwing that away if you got a 90 day to start with and it was not the right drug, and so on. So I could this is a big discussion when you get into it, and I think what the making the mail order more accessible was a result of that, because the legislator whose wife had the problem got that bill to the floor of the House, and there was a lot of discussion, and I think there were some changes in the rules to facilitate that. But this is a good discussion in terms of cost saving, and I guess that's something that we would, I think that's where Senator Fisher was going, is how can we save the doctors? Now, my prescriptions are written. I don't have to go to the doctor. I just go to the pharmacist, and they give him my prescription because it's forever, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, we pay a $3.50 dispensing fee for each prescription that is filled. So the savings from a retail pharmacy of getting 90 days at one time would be one $3.50 charge instead of three of them.
Okay.
And that has to be balanced against how much wastage there might be if 90 days was dispensed rather than 30.
And the other, going along with this discussion, one of the directives coming out of the 2001 session was that we should look at actually further limiting the initial prescription for a maintenance drug. And, in fact, we did put in place a program that would limit the initial dispensing on a chronic use drug to 15 days, and with the expectation that there would be some savings in the end, even though you would be paying another dispensing fee for someone renewing that prescription. But that it would avoid the waste. And so we did put that in place. Our experience after operating that for about 8 months or so, was that not only was it not saving us money, it was costing us a little more money. And so we came back to the emergency board and got authorization to rescind that rule.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, it's just kind of interesting because back in about the 95 session, I believe it was, several of the agencies were on the kick that if they got a fee or a tax refund or that kind of thing that was below $10, that they didn't have to send it back because it costs more than that to actually do the check and mail it and go through the process. And I said, that's great, providing that if anything that you receive is under $10, that the people don't have to pay that, you know, if it's fair and square. Well, the idea was it didn't cost anybody else anything to do a check, but it cost the government, wasn't worth sending back anything under $10. Now, if you can save to paying two checks, and if you're no more efficient than some of those places where they're saying that it costs more than $10 to do a check, you're only willing to give the pharmacist $3.50. You're saving $7 there. Are you saving another $20 by not having to pay those extra two times for the drug? I mean, my feeling is there's absolutely no consideration given for any of the expense that the government's running through other than just what they're trying to beat out of the pharmacist.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, you know, I don't have the answer to that question. Certainly that is a piece, though, of what we will be looking at as we move farther into the mail order program, where we have a comparator in terms of a system in which, you know, we are seeing some significant use and getting 90-day supplies versus the one-month supply.
Senator Minnich.
Lynn, how, or I don't know your name, I'm sorry.
Jim.
How do you currently pay the pharmacies that are participating in the plan now? How does that happen?
I'm not sure I understand your question. The pharmacies are paid through the download of the information from the PBM, the Pharmacy Benefit Manager, to the payment system in OMAP, and on a weekly basis, that process cuts checks for the pharmacies, and they're reimbursed through that process.
Do we actually write checks and put it in the mail and send it, or do we electronically transfer it?
Is there electronic payment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, there are checks that are written, and we don't do electronic transfer of payments in the Medicaid system. We can send electronic remittance advices, providing all the detail of the payment, but the check is actually written by the computer. It's all an automated process. There isn't a human intervention needed in that process. In terms of the download.
What checks are we writing a month or every week?
We don't write a check for every single person who accesses the system. It's a check to the pharmacy for the Medicaid business that processed through our system during that week. And actually, let's see, I think I've got something here with a little bit of information. We process 1.7 million claims a month. Now, some of those are capitation payments. Now, that isn't how many checks we write. The
right.
claims are for the individual.
Right.
And I'll see if I can find some information. I'm sure there's information in terms of the number of actual checks generated.
Mr. Chairman, if it's like 10, then obviously it's de minimis savings at all. But if you're talking about 300,000 that go out every week or even 20,000, electronic transfer may provide some savings.
Absolutely. That certainly has been mentioned many times by the provider community and the managed care plans that they would like to see electronic transfer.
Do you have the capability of doing that?
Mr. Chair, we do not have that capability at this time.
So
we are moving forward with the procurement of a new Medicaid management information system.
Okay.
And I know that's been identified as one of the desired features.
Okay, and as you get into that, you will do a cost analysis, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes.
I hate to sound like a dummy here, but the state of Oregon banks with somebody, some bank, right? They can do electronic transfers. So, well, I guess I'm trying to figure out technologically why we have to form a committee to do a study to figure out why it is we can do or can't do what everybody else in the world is doing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't have an answer for you on that. I do know that our systems folks have looked at it in the past and have said our current computer system would not allow us to do that, and that it should be looked at as a part of the new MMIS.
Well, yeah. Maybe the magnitude of numbers could have something to do with
it. What, 1.5 million doesn't transfer like $10?
No, 1.5 million.
Electronically, I mean, come on.
1.5 million transfers, plans, right?
Well, it was 1.7 million claims that come into our system, which generate a fewer number of actual checks.
But, Mr. Chairman, small businesses call their numbers in to people that process their payroll. And this week I've got 5 employees, and I've got, here's the amount that I owe to these vendors. Press a button, it's gone. End of story.
There are two things. One is we will go back and we will get some more information and provide that to you in terms of why the decision has been made at this point that that's not feasible for the state. The other comment I would make is that obviously, how fast you pay out your claims and how fast you transfer your money makes a difference to the state treasury. It doesn't make a difference to our budget, but it does to the state treasury. However, a piece of the pharmacy claims processing system is that one of the good things from a provider perspective is that it's very fast. You fill a claim during the week, and you have a check that's in the mail the following Monday. Some of the other claims that are done on a paper basis that aren't done electronically in this way don't process as quickly.
Okay. Now, I'm going to call time out here for just a minute.
Privilege of the chair.
I know. Thank you. Okay, we're going to talk about pharmaceuticals. We're talking about reimbursement. We're talking about that now, right?
Yes. Would you like me to go on with where I was at? Okay.
Then we have constraints on the system and suggestions for the future. So we are on reimbursements, right?
Reimbursements.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Yeah, there are, because we're just getting down to the good part.
Okay, good. Go ahead. Go ahead.
What control do you have on the PBMs? How are they paid, and what are they required to do? Is there any watchdog over them?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fisher, the contract that we have in place with the PBM is our controlling document and our controlling mechanism with the PBM. The PBM actually works not just for us in Oregon, but for a number of corporations and states, and has contracts with each of them, and the contract provisions are the controlling device for working with that organization.
And are those monitored?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, the contracting department in DHS would be the monitoring people for that, yes.
And we would also do monitoring within OMAP in terms of just ongoing contract management, in terms of are the claims being processed as quickly as they should be, per our contract? Are the requests that we're making for changes to the computer system being implemented quickly? Are providers being paid within the appropriate time frame? Are, in the case of something that's being prior authorized, is there an immediate response according to the contractual time frames and getting back to a provider with an answer and a prior authorization? Those kinds of things we do monitor also within our program.
Okay. Now, that gets back to the question I asked about an audit, and I don't know who told me or where I heard it, but I know there was some talk about an audit on the PBM. Now, is there, tell me again, You do the oversight.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We do the oversight as part of having a contract with an outside vendor. It's our responsibility to see that we're getting the value that that we're paying for. But it also makes prudent business sense that periodically you would target for some kind of outside review to make sure that you have another expertise look at that. And I think the PBM is a good example of one of our vendors, that we have no reason to think that there is a problem with the PBM, but to look at it for efficiencies, are there things that could be done better? The PBM basically is the mechanism for generating payment for one of the largest components of our budget, which is the drug budget. The PBM also collects the federal rebates from the drug manufacturers, and so they also, passing through the PBM, is one of our largest revenue sources to the state. And so that was, as I said in the past, we talked to the Secretary of State. They weren't interested in doing that. There is at least one outside firm that would be interested in doing that. And we were going to move forward as a part of our budget-making process, policy package in order to fund that outside audit. And that was pulled out as we were scaling back in terms of what could move forward in the budget process this time.
Thank you.
Yeah, you must feel that it's cheaper to have the PBM do that than it is to hire people at the state level to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, that certainly has been our experience so far. We don't have the system in place. A part of what you have to do to pay drug claims under federal regulations is you have to have what's called a point of sale system. You can go in and the pharmacy can quickly, a matter of seconds, enter information via their system that goes directly into the central place, who's got a database that looks at drug interactions, past drugs that someone has been prescribed, and does those kinds of things. The cost of the PBM is it's under 1%. It's about 0.8% administrative costs for the PBM because of the huge volume that goes through that system. Now, I know that there are some proposals being looked at by the legislature. I think maybe there will be a bill, if it hasn't already been introduced, looking at the concept of a public PBM as opposed to going through a private firm. So there will be an opportunity to look at that as a future vehicle as well for the state.
Mr. Chair, that wasn't exactly where my question was heading. My question was heading to the point that if it is cheaper to go through the private PBM and have them pay the checks and what we can do it at the state level, might we not then infer or deduce that it would be a whale lot cheaper to have them also look at the 1.5 million or whatever it is procedures that come through instead of having our state people do it and save some more money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I'm afraid I misled you a bit in terms of the complete role of the PBM. What the PBM does is generate basically within their system, after going through all of these edits and providing information to the pharmacy, it generates an electronic claim. That electronic claim then transfers overnight to our MMIS claims payment system, and then our computer system takes that claim and runs it through for payment in the weekend cycle. So there are actually two computer systems involved. It is a state check that goes out to the provider. And all of that is basically done without human intervention. So it's very cost efficient. Whereas some of the other claims that process through our system involve data entry for individuals who aren't using electronic means.
I just was interested when you said that they were like only a 0.8%
Yes, and just to give you
administration, I mean, how many of our government agencies operate on anyways near that kind of efficiency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, certainly we do not, although I can say that in OMAP, when we look at, we do a lot of leveraging through our budget where we claim federal match. If I pull that portion out of our budget, OMAP's administrative cost is about 2%. So the 0.8 is definitely less than ours.
0.18 or 0.8?
The PBM is 0.8. Oh. OMAP is 2%.
Okay, PBM is
2.0. Oh, okay. And the department as a whole is 4%. And Medicare, I believe the Medicare program operates at about 2%.
Okay. We have a tiger by the tail here. I don't know. How long? Go ahead.
Well, I'm looking at, you said you got two computers, PBM, OMAP, back and forth information, et cetera. One costs 0.8%, the other one's 2%. What is the difference? Why the additional cost?
The 2%, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it's our overall OMAP administration. It's not the computer piece. It's all of our staff, our contracts. It even includes the contract with the PBM, are included in that 2%.
Okay. Well, and I don't know that we need to get into it now, but I think it begs the question, what do these people do?
PBM has to do the same contract.
I'm sure they do something, but I'm not sure what they actually
PBM?
Well, no, I'm trying to figure out what OMAP
what
is,
OMAP
the relationship
does
to all of this stuff, and whether we have employees dedicated to a function that, and again, I won't take the committee's time, but I'm trying to figure out, so much of this is accomplished by electronic means and computer systems, et cetera. So in OMAP, I know we have personnel who are in this, somehow related to this program, or are there not people related to this? You understand where I'm going?
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, indeed there are staff. The OMAP staff are, I think our staff are 172. Let me double check that. For 0103, the average is 163. It's 174 listed for 0305. That incorporates the OHP2 increase that we've seen. Indeed, there are staff that are engaged in the pharmacy program. We have a pharmacy manager, an individual who is responsible for the policies and procedures, looking, being knowledgeable about what opportunities there are out there to save money in the program, to manage the program, to manage the contract, and so there are a wide variety of functions that are performed by OMAP staff. In some cases, we are processing claims. There are claims that are suspending for medical review. Some claims suspend for a manual pricing. There are prior authorizations that occur, particularly in the arena of durable medical equipment, some of the therapies. So there are a number of functions.
Right. And we probably don't need to take the committee's time on this, but we're kind of mixing apples and oranges. And just maybe a follow-up question. Have you had a systems analysis or an operational overview or any of this kind of thing to look at efficiencies and economies? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, yes, we have had someone come in and do an evaluation, paying particular attention to the claims processing side of the operation, and we've implemented a number of the recommendations that have come out of that process. And we do view that as our responsibility to continue to look for those efficiencies.
Do you have a flow chart of some sort
of your department? Do you have something that we can look at to get a sense of the magnitude of what you're doing, the different departments, and so on and so forth?
Mr. Chair, we do have some simple organizational charts that describe the functions within each of the sections. Mm-hmm. It is also possible, although I haven't looked at it for 2 years now, there is a more complicated document that is an actual flow chart that shows basically what happens when a claim comes into the system and how it processes through the system, and that may be of value to you.
Okay. Well, I guess part of what we're doing is trying to look at the systems and the efficiencies and plan ahead and so on, and I guess that's why we're asking these questions. So I guess any of that information, I don't know if we want to, do you want a two-year-old flowchart?
No, I really don't, because I think I've got all of that stuff somewhere else. But I'm just wondering if you're having these discussions or if OMAP's having these discussions anywhere else with respect to where we can invest in software or things that we know will speed up the process. I'm thinking of the police department I work at. Police reports come in. They're all handwritten. You know, we have people that sit and they read the reports and try to figure out what these college-educated cops have written in their indistinguishable cursive writing. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I've noticed.
Yeah, mine's very good by comparison. I can show you some that are just amazing. Sometimes you can't show what in the world happened. But so there's some functions that by necessity cannot, I mean, you just simply can't take a handwritten police report and scan it into a computer system, at least not yet. So I guess what my question is whether or not there are some analyses of efficiencies that can be accomplished by, you know, downloading certain data or having reports typed into a computer and download it, et cetera.
Right.
So, for instance, the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department right now, all of their deputies have laptop computers. They generate their reports on their computer. When they come in from their shift at the end of the day, they download all of the reports directly into their system. Portland Police Bureau hasn't caught up with that, but they're getting there. So I don't know if that kind of an application even works in your environments.
It does, Mr. Chair, Senator Menas. There are a number of things that are being done. One of the things is over the years we have worked closely with the provider community in terms of encouraging electronic claims, and now over 90% of our claims are electronic claims. We are moving forward in the data entry side to do an imaging system that scans those claims and enters them into the system. I don't think that's been implemented yet, but it's scheduled.
Yeah. Well, one of the major costs of any reorganization is upgrading a computer system. That is a huge cost. And, you know, to figure out how much money you're going to save by spending multi-millions of dollars upgrading a computer system is something to consider, too. But, I think the incremental changes, and sometimes you have to take the quantum leap, but I know that the reorganization of, you know, human services is a nightmare trying to connect all of the people. You know, they can be, well, anyway, the computer system is huge.
It is, and Mr. Chair, it's multiple computer
yeah.
systems,
yeah.
Which contributes to that issue. There is work as a part of the procurement of a new MMIS, Medicaid Management Information System, looking at a central database in terms of all of the eligibility information coming from various parts of the department being in a central place to draw down that data. The other major computer system that is underway right now is a decision support and surveillance and utilization review system, and that's in the process of actually being implemented right now, and it'll be in testing shortly. And this is a system that will be the vehicle for identifying overuse and abuse and fraud. That's the SURS part of it, the surveillance and utilization review component. And the decision support is a part of the system will allow us to do a lot more program management, to more readily access data, to generate reports that will allow us to look and see what areas we should target for future changes.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
You know, this is the thing that boggles my mind. You're talking about all the multi-million dollars and all this kind of stuff that it costs you to do your computer system, and I can't believe that the PBM doesn't have to do updates and upgrades and all this kind of stuff, yet they're doing it 2.5 times cheaper than you are. And I'm pretty sure they're not going broke. I think they're making money. And you say you've got to watch they've got to watch their contract with you, I would think, just as much. And I guess I just don't understand this. It almost looks like we ought to turn this all over to PBM and get out of the business from the government angle of it, because you're talking about enough money and the difference in management administrative costs. You're talking about enough money to bail us out of a lot of the problems that we're having here serving people that are out there hurting.
A couple of comments, Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher. One is the cost of the PBM is included in that 2% number that I mentioned. That we're counting that as OMAP administrative cost. It happens to be a portion of our cost that we contract out to the private sector. The DS-SIRS computer system that I just talked about, that is a contracted out system that's being put in place right now. The MMIS procurement process, they looked at a number of options, and the one that moved forward through the I forget the name of the Joint Committee on Information Systems and Technology, I believe. The recommendation that came out of that process is that we would, in building that system, continue to contract out the PBM, the pharmacy component, continue to contract out the DSSERS component, which we're just now implementing, and that instead for the other portion of the MMIS that gets to eligibility, the history components, reference files, the managed care components, that those we would seek a system from another state, one that is a state-of-the-art system, and make whatever adaptions we need to make it work, meet the Oregon requirements. But then that would be operated by state staff. That's gone through the legislative process in terms of moving forward with that approach.
Okay. I can understand how you might be comparing apples and oranges on this. You know, a PBM, is that a that's a large organization that has a very narrow focus. And you're running an agency that has a broader focus, right? PBM is a part of what you're doing.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Yeah, and so I think that, and then also, the major investment is getting a system. Now, if I were going to go into business to do a very specialized job and spend up front a huge amount of money, and once I got it developed, I could do the best job of anybody. And I think that's how they, but as a state agency, you know, I agree with Senator Fisher that I think if we can find people out there who has a who have a better system that they've invested in to do some of the functions, I think that's great. There are some functions that for PERS and others that we have to upgrade. But you know, and so I think it's a very complicated thing, obviously, and I think it's, you know, until you actually do the cost analysis of which is cheapest, and I'm sure that's what you must be doing.
Absolutely.
It's hard to say. Senator Minnis, and then I hope we can get on.
Lynn, I thank you for bearing with us. More questions about it. You mentioned that this is 0.8 in the PBM. Is it 0.8 of the 2% administrative cost, or is it 0.8 of the overall cost of OMAP?
It's 0.8 of the pharmacy fee-for-service cost.
But it's not 0.8 of the 2% administrative cost.
Yeah, but that 0.8 is included in our 2%. What we do in terms...
But it's 0.8 of what? 0.8 of the overall OMAP budget.
Of the overall OMAP
okay,
budget.
0.8 of the overall budget.
Well, the 0.8 is only of a portion of the OMAP budget. The 2% is the overall OMAP budget. So that 0.8 is just a subcomponent.
I'm really confused, but I'll belabor the point.
Mr. Chair, maybe just one more comment on this. You're entirely right that the PBM operates so efficiently because it does a very narrow range of functions, does a very high volume, and does them very efficiently. If I could make an analogy, it's a little bit like when you're building a house. Everyone hires out the drywalling because a drywaller can do it so much more efficiently because they do such a high volume of it. And drywallers wouldn't build a whole house, but the drywalling they can do so much more efficiently than anyone else that, of course, everyone hires that out. And we're seeing that PBMs are hired by states and large organizations for that very reason, because they do a narrow range of services very efficiently.
Yeah. Well, no, I think this is a good discussion, and I think that, you know, Senator Fisher...
Well, the whole thing, if you want to get back to that analogy, is that almost everything is bid out to people that are craftsmen and very skilled at what they do, from the framing to the cement work to the ground prep to the finishing out to the electrical to the plumbing, and everything else is done on that same basis. And so it looks like we've chosen one thing to say here, that that's all that could be done at a better rate, and I'm not sure that I agree with that.
Well, I think those are decisions that have to be made when you find something that you select. I was on a committee to farm out the motor pool, you know, and that's another thing that we have to look at to see if it's cost effective and so on. And I think each one of those have to be looked at, and maybe we do, maybe we don't. Onward, please.
Okay. I was at the point of talking about reimbursements, about payment systems in OMAP. The current dispensing fee that we pay for filling up a prescription is $3 for a retail prescription, $3.50 for a retail prescription, $3.50 in mail order also, and $3.80 for the institutional pharmacies that provide prescriptions to institutions. The ingredient reimbursement is the average wholesale price less minus 14%. And in the mail order program, we get average wholesale price minus 21% for brand name and minus 60% for generic drugs. So we get quite a bit better price on the ingredient fee from mail order. Also, in payments, there is an Oregon maximum allowable cost for the multi-source generic drugs, and we pay the lowest of the available prices there. The federal government has a payment system called the federal upper limit, where they've done some evaluation of costs, and we take that into consideration when we make payments. And then there's the billed amount, and we will pay the lowest of those costs, whether it's a billed amount or the Oregon maximum allowable or the federal upper limit or AWP minus 14. I'll talk for a minute about copayments. In the OHP Plus benefit package, we have a $2 copayment on generic drugs and a $3 copayment on brand name drugs. That copayment is called a voluntary copayment because the federal government has a regulation that says that if a client cannot pay a copayment, that cannot be a reason to not provide the service to the client. There are some exceptions in the OHP Plus population to that. Children under the age of 19, pregnant women, and certain home and community service clients are waived from that. If the mail order process is used, there's no copayment, and so that's another savings to the client. In the OHP standard population, the more limited benefit package that has just been implemented, the copayments are $2 for a generic drug, $3 for a brand name HIV, AIDS, or mental health or cancer drug, and $15 for an other brand name drug. And that will be in place through this month, and then the OHP standard population will be losing its prescription drug benefit at the end of this month. So that's just a one-month coverage then.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Fisher.
You said it's a federal requirement that the copay is not to stand in the way of them getting a prescription. It was not my understanding, serving on the WASC committee, that there was a federal requirement. It was my impression that that was put in there in the request for the waiver, and they merely accepted our recommendations.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fisher, in the waiver application that the Waiver Application Steering Committee developed, there was a request placed in there for a waiver from this particular federal requirement, and the federal government allowed it for the expansion population, for the population that's not categorically eligible for the Medicaid program. We don't think that they would allow such a waiver for the categorically eligible population, the population that's now in the OHP Plus benefit package. But they did allow us to charge higher copayments and to charge mandatory copayments for the population that they can consider the expansion population that's not traditionally a part of the Medicaid program.
But it was not asked for.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, no, we did not ask for a waiver for the OHP Plus population.
We don't know that the Fed required it. It was a choice that we made, and not the WASC Steering Committee. It was a choice made by others.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, yes, you're right. That choice was made to ask for that waiver for the expansion population only.
Okay, thanks. John?
Somebody needs to go back to Health Plan 101, OHP Standard, OHP Plus. Which ones are the categorical eligibles?
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, the categorical eligibles are OHP plus.
OHP plus, okay. It seems to me like the categorical eligibles should be the standard program. But it's just
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, I've heard that comment often, that it maybe is a little bit confusing the way that those were named. Unfortunately, that's the way they were named in House Bill 2519, and so that was carried forward into the...
Okay, so the categorical eligibles are, of course, those are the ones that we do provide under federal law certain services to. Now, do they lose prescription benefit?
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, no, they did not.
They don't. So it's just that population, that 100,000 population in the standard program that are going to lose. Okay, now, we're going to continue to pay for other benefits, I assume hospitalization and office visits. Is there someone who's going to be tracking the hospitalization and or the physician visits and this kind of thing once that shuts off?
And that was
to see if we have an increase?
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, yes, we will be tracking very closely the cost of services to this population and any changes that occur in the cost of services to this population.
It's one of the tricks. If we cut off the pharmaceutical benefit and if I was a person in this category, could I get a prescription if I went to a hospital or an emergency room and have it paid for by the plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, certainly there is that potential that if you were seen by the hospital emergency room and the rules that govern their dispensing drugs there could apply. So it may not be the most cost-effective, certainly isn't the most cost-effective way to deliver drugs. Just to let you know what's happened in the delivery system around this issue, with the failure of ballot measure 28, of course, this was one of the actions that was put in place, was elimination of this benefit. And the managed care plans that are serving the majority of our clients were given the opportunity to decide to serve or not serve this OHP standard population because, of course, it's going to be very difficult to manage the health of individuals who don't have a drug benefit, prescription drug benefit, as well as other services. They don't have medical supplies. They don't have durable medical equipment, mental health and chemical dependency services. And seven of our plans chose to continue serving this population with some adjustment to their capitation rates for changes in utilization as a result of not having these benefits. And seven plans chose to stop serving this population, at least at this time. The seven plans, though, that are no longer serving our population represent 70% of the eligibles. So those 70% of the clients will be served in our fee-for-service system. Mm-hmm. We will see fairly quickly the impacts of not providing this benefit in terms of the changes in costs and utilization in that system.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The names. This 100,000 that are losing their drug privileges, they didn't have Oregon Health Plan at all prior to this new waiver. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, no, these are the people who became entitled to Oregon Health Plan benefits when we started the Oregon Health Plan back in 1994. So it's 100,000 people we've basically been serving, or people like them, since 1994. The people with the new waiver that become newly entitled to benefits under the Oregon Health Plan are people at a higher income level above 100% of poverty. We initially were going to go to 110% and then come back to the emergency board. That's been delayed, so we're not doing that expansion until it was delayed to July. My assumption is it will continue to have a delay associated with it. So we haven't expanded that population as part of the Oregon Health Plan 2 right now with the new waivers. Well, we have expanded coverage for pregnant women and children under age 19. We did that February 1 from 170% of the poverty level to 185% of the poverty level.
Now,
and they
not,
have
did you not say they were the 100,000 of those on the standard?
Right, the 100,000 on the standard are people that have been on our program in the past, have had the full OHP benefit up until February 1. And now they have a reduced benefit, and it'll be further reduced in March.
I thought the ones that plus were the eligible were the ones that have been on it.
Now, the plus are the ones that fit the categories that are traditionally eligible for Medicaid under the federal Medicaid program. They're TANF clients.
Could you get us
yes.
couple of lists, the delineation, so we've... Because I was writing some of these things down, too, because standard...
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischer, there are a little over 400,000 people in both of these programs.
Yes, I understand.
300,000 of them are the folks that are traditionally categorically eligible and now are plus. The 100,000 is the expansion population that now is standard and will be losing these benefits.
But they have been receiving benefits up until, I mean, from the very beginning?
Mr. Yes. Chair, that's right.
And they're going to lose them.
They're going to lose some of their benefits.
Of them,
Mr. Chair.
But
yeah.
Maybe all...
A follow-up.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Ned.
Does not the measure or House Bill 5075 cover this 100,000 people as it came out of the House?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischer, no, it does not. The House Bill 5075 addresses a different program, the medically needy program. Those are not included in this 100,000 individuals. The medically needy program served about 8,000 individuals. It did end February 1. And it had a limited benefit package that was just prescription drugs, mental health, chemical dependency services, and then transportation to access those services. And so those 8,000 people did lose their benefits. The primary use of that program, of course, was prescription drugs. And these were, 75-80% of these individuals had Medicare. They are disabled or seniors. And, of course, Medicare doesn't provide that prescription drug benefit.
Unless they're in the hospital.
Correct. And so those are the people who are impacted by House Bill 5075. There are also, I think, another group, which are people in the long-term care system who were in the survival priority levels 10 through 14 are addressed in that bill as well.
It was my understanding that 100,000 drug benefits were covered in
57. No, they are not.
Okay. Senator Minnis.
I was going to say there was a lot of work done during, I think, the fifth special session, and I know your agency presented a lot of material. Rick Berkobian, who staffed that committee, I believe we have all of that information available to us. So I would just suggest that we contact Rick. I know at one point he was going to prepare binders and that information.
Oh, that was that secret meeting that you guys had, right?
Yeah, top secret. In front of John and everybody. But what I'm saying, Lynn, is rather than you duplicating all the information, I think we should probably go to our own staff. But I believe they've got all of that information right now.
In front of God, but everybody but the Democrats, right?
I thought you guys were God.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Menas, we'd be glad to work with the committee administrator to make sure that you, in one fashion or another, have the requested information.
You better do it while you have time.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I have one more comment on payments, and then we'll get into constraints. We're just going to mention drug rebates. The federal government has negotiated with drug manufacturers drug rebates for states operating Medicaid programs. Those drug rebates average, they're different for different drugs, different manufacturers, but they average 18% of the paid amount. And of that, 40% goes to the state and 60% goes to the federal government. So that is a reduced cost to us and something that's a savings to us.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
On this whole drug rebate thing, is there like a game board or something you can get that can help you understand how this works? Because, you know, it's amazing. I mean, we talk about, you know, average wholesale price minus 15, 16, 17, whatever it is. I go to a conference in New Orleans where they're presenting and the NCSL is talking about AWP means absolutely nothing. Which even confuses me more. And then I find out that oncologists can buy their drugs for about 20%, and then they get reimbursed at 80%. And then I find out that the Congress knows this, and because that, is there any place where all of that stuff is summed up? Because it seems like a huge fiction, and like a what is that, P game with shell game? Because I can't figure out who's winning here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, the drug manufacturers are definitely winning this game.
But maybe they are. I just don't know. I mean, but between the federal government, between the state government, between the local governments, and all of that movement and pass through. The other thing, and I do understand that there are some of the generic drugs are now increasing in price, and I've been told that some of the pharmaceutical manufacturers are now buying up the manufacturers of the generic drugs. So it seems like a who knows what, but. It would be interesting to have like a game board or something or a diagram that tried to explain what in the heck.
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, the game board not only is almost too complex to understand, but it's constantly changing as different agreements are made between drug manufacturers and states and the federal government. Different ways of negotiating prices are developed, and there is no easy way to do it. I happen to be a pharmacist myself, and I have some understanding of this.
But against the wall, who's the only guy that understands the
it's a little bit like the car sales system. There just is no way to know exactly what the true cost of a drug is, but what we have to do is the best negotiation possible to get the best price for Oregon.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If Senator Minnis got a hold of that game board, he'd find out it was rigged to help out the government. Were a private sector provider able to get a game board that would provide kickbacks and rebates, he'd go to jail.
So do you want to see the game board or not?
I know what I don't.
Well, you mean private sector provider the kickbacks that are fraudulently kickback?
No,
the $2 billion fraudulent.
I like that because I bought so many drugs without a kickback, and I didn't take that off my price and everything else to declare it one thing and another. I'd be in jail.
Some of them are in jail.
Some of them. Government
people
are in jail too.
Sorry,
Lynn. I'm about halfway through my part of the presentation, and then we have Lynn's part.
Okay, let's stop for just a minute, Senator Minnis. The information that we asked about, you say that has been gathered during the interim, and that we can get some of that. Then, because
particularly all the stuff on the plus plan and standard.
Okay.
They submitted tons of material.
Okay, good. That was an open meeting too, right?
Yes, sir, it was. Actually, there were Democrats on that.
There were Democrats on that. Good. Lynn, are you... I'm sorry.
I have a little more. Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
You wanted us to talk about constraints on our system.
Yes.
And I'm going to talk for a few minutes about some constraints, some things that might be preventing us from getting increased savings, possibly. I'll talk first about the preferred drug list, the practitioner-managed drug prescription program. Whether people agree with that or disagree with that as a good tool, and I know there are differences of opinion about that, but there are some restrictions in that program. That program is not a true formulary, which a formulary is a very efficient tool to control drug costs and to restrict high-cost drugs. The preferred drug list, for one thing, does not allow evaluation of certain classes of drugs. The HIV, AIDS drugs, the mental health drugs, the cancer drugs have been specifically excluded by law from consideration in that program. So that's a bit of a constraint. There could be considerably more savings made if those were included in that program. The preferred drug list also is basically a voluntary program on the part of providers to prescribe the preferred drug and is not a mandatory requirement. And if more teeth were placed into that list in some way, there would be considerable increased savings to the state. So I'll just throw those couple of ideas out as ideas that it got us partway towards a formulary type of program in the state. It's a very technically perfect system as far as evaluation and looking at scientific basis of putting the drugs on the system, but it has some limitations on the savings because of its voluntary nature and not having much in the way of teeth in it.
Okay. Senator Mass?
Well, having had some part in the creation of that thing, albeit somewhat reluctantly, the premise behind, of course, is we named it the practitioner-managed plan because the idea was that the practitioners would, to some degree, manage this. And it begged the question whether or not physicians understood or knew the availability of medications that were available for substitution. And I guess I'm getting information that physicians don't or won't or are lazy or I don't know what the deal is. But it occurs to me, again, out of this conference that I went to, the American Medical Association does not require physicians to take continuing medical education courses, which I found fascinating. And I asked the question a few times here. I know that not all physicians are members of the Oregon Medical Association, and I'm not sure if the Oregon Medical Association, those members, are required to do CMEs. I've been told that some liability insurance policies that insure physicians require CMEs as a matter of course for their insuring those populations. And I know that physicians generally reject the idea of the state mandating certain training. But do you think that it would be profitable to require physicians to actually have some training with respect to pharmaceuticals and prescription writing and evidence-based practices with this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, the short answer to that is yes, I think that would be useful. I think anything we can do to better educate physicians and other practitioners about the benefits to the client and to the state of Oregon of providing the lower cost alternatives, if they are as effective or more effective than other drugs in the class, that's a good thing. Yes.
If I could chime in, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I did pick up on the one word that you used in there is to require the physicians to participate. And certainly that, would be something that would flow from the work of this body. But there may be some other opportunities for us to work more closely with the Oregon Medical Association, with the Oregon School of Pharmacy, in developing some opportunities for physicians to those who do CME, continuing medical education courses, and to get some of that training certified for CME credit. And we will certainly look into that.
Okay. That. Go ahead. All right.
No, I'm done. I'm going to thank Lynn. That's a good idea.
Okay. So what Senator Minnis is suggesting would be to add some things to what is already being required of the physicians in terms of their update, right?
I think we require anything.
Or do we? Do we or do we not?
Mr. Chair, we, OMAP, don't require continuing medical education requirements. The Board of Medical Examiners is probably where a requirement would normally flow from, and I don't know what the requirements are related to CMEs.
That was my question. I
do know that physicians do continuing medical education, but whether it's a requirement or not, I do not know.
Well, so I think is a good point.
And Mr. Chairman, just something that might tie into this. I know the Judiciary Committee, later this session, the House Judiciary is beginning to look at the medical liability tort issues, insurance issues, and so on and so forth. So that committee will have an opportunity to look at some of those issues also. There is a proposal in the building to create a liability insurance program similar to what attorneys have, which is the PLF, and all attorneys in the Oregon State Bar are required to be part of the PLF. It's an interesting concept, but all physicians in Oregon are not members of the Oregon Medical Association, which is another interesting concept if you try to incorporate them. But it is possible that through some legislation that some of these ideas can be pursued.
You must have talked to the same attorney that I talked to this morning.
Well, I was at the Oregon Trial Lawyer Lunch.
That's what I talked about. The insurance pool that they have as opposed to the physician. Okay. Lynn? Jim?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move on from the concept of a formulary and talk for a minute about prior authorization. We do have the ability to require prior authorization on some drugs, and we do it for medical necessity, for non-covered conditions on the prioritized list, for inappropriate use of medications. We don't presently have in state statute the right to require prior authorization of a drug for cost savings, just for cost savings. That's a bit of a constraint. If we could use the prior authorization tool as an incentive to encourage practitioners to prescribe lower cost drugs, that would be something that we could get some cost savings from.
Well,
yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about that, because prior authorization is never very quick. It can be complex, and it can be often detrimental to the patient. So if you want prior authorization for prescriptions in the statute, you'd sure have to require some speedy response to that, don't you think?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, yes. We wouldn't want to interfere with a patient getting a drug with a prior authorization requirement. We do have the ability now, though, with real-time and on-screen access between the PBM and providers to have that happen very quickly. So a prior authorization can just be a reminder that there might be a reason not to prescribe a particular drug. And if one of the reasons could be that the cost is 10 times as much as another drug that would do the same thing, that might be a reason for us to want to encourage the lower cost drug. But if that's the only reason, we are prohibited from using the prior authorization tool to do that encouragement.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
Who would you suggest would be behind that computer screen making that decision about using the drug that the doctor has recommended and one that you disagree with?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Walker, the PBM employs pharmacists and pharmacy technicians and they perform that function of prior authorization for states who use prior authorization as a tool, and they have professionals on staff that do that.
Okay, thank you. Okay,
to move on, there are some federal restrictions, not that the state can do much about that, but there are limits on the drug rebates, and we feel that it should be possible to negotiate higher rebates than the federal government negotiates, and that's an avenue that could be pursued for additional cost savings. There's also the restriction that the federal government pretty much has to agree with all of the cost-saving measures that Oregon wants to implement, and that's always a difficult and time-consuming process. Again, not something that Oregon has a lot of control over, but it is a constraint. And then one other aspect of constraints, kind of on the other side of things, is the issue of access. And we want to be careful that we don't put limits on the payment of drugs and limits on the prescribing of drugs that will affect access, because access is important. And so that's one of the balancers that we have to take into consideration as we look at cost savings, is to make sure we don't negatively influence the ability of clients to have access to health care.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Mills.
Jim or Lynn, help me understand, because all of the states are, I assume, having the same kinds of discussions with the federal government. Is there one entity that facilitates the discussion? Does the Council of State Governments do anything, or is each state left to its own devices to go out and try to negotiate what they can with their congressional delegations, or how does that happen?
I'll take a try at it, Mr. Chair, Senator Menas. Indeed, there is a national group of the states working together in terms of working through the federal drug rebate process. The actual rebate negotiation is done by the federal government in terms of and it's held close to the vest in terms of what the rebate is from any manufacturer for a specific drug. And so that is done on a national basis. And the federal government is actually relooking at how those rebates are currently negotiated and what they're negotiated against in terms of that issue of average wholesale price and whether or not that really means something. But in supplemental rebates are something that states are doing individually for the most part, but there are some opportunities surfacing right now where states are coming together and looking at some purchasing power with a broader base. And you can go out in your Medicaid programs and negotiate a supplemental rebate with a drug manufacturer. And, in fact, we have just submitted a request to the federal government to allow us to have permission to do that in Oregon. But generally, you have to have something to bargain with in order to get the supplemental rebate.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Maybe we ought to send all these people that want the services to Senator White and Senator Whip-Smith's office here and let them kind of beat on their doors a little bit.
Well, it certainly is where the most effective solution will be found at the federal level, or should be found at the federal level.
And, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up question. I do know that the Congress is now reviewing the issue of prescription drugs, and there's a prescription drug benefit package. Do we have a liaison or a group of individuals who are communicating our desires as a state with respect to where the Congress should be going or where we think they should be going with respect to the benefit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menas, are you referring to the proposed Medicare benefit? Or at this point, certainly our office isn't engaged in that direct interaction.
And Mr. Chairman, Medicare, Medicaid, I don't care. I mean, we've got the National PACE organization that coordinates between Medicare, Medicaid for seniors, et cetera. What I guess I'm concerned about is that there doesn't seem to be any one individual or one group or one office in the state of Oregon that is responsible for pulling together the ideas and sending to the Congress our collective thoughts on what we think should happen to benefit the states. Now, we know there's going to be a prescription drug benefit package. We know the Congress is going to spend a certain amount of money, but I don't know that we have anybody in the state system that's actually advocating for anything.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menas, I would suggest that perhaps this is a discussion that can be continued with Bruce Goldberg with the Office of Health Policy and Research, that tends to be a center point for us to have that one voice to look at the issues that impact health care in the state. And there is an opportunity, I think, for us to coalesce around that as well as in the governor's office.
And again, Mr. Chairman, I have suggested in this committee and other places that the governor's office, that the leadership of these, the Senate and the House and others get together and formulate some strategy to make this argument to the Congress. And absent any kind of argument, they're going to do whatever they want.
Well, the governor has certainly indicated an interest in addressing the pharmaceutical cost issue and access issue.
We ought to send him on a trip.
Okay, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time and to leave Lynn just a few minutes to talk about non-pharmacy things, maybe I'll skip a few bullets here and I'll give them to you in a handout that you can see later, and if you have questions about them, you can let us know. I was going to talk about budgetary constraints and cost containment measures we've taken. I'll skip over those and go to kind of a summary of what we see as our needs to achieve more savings in the pharmacy program. And basically, it's kind of summarized in the fact that we need the ability to operate more like the private sector, with less constraints. We need some enhanced effectiveness of the preferred drug list. We need some more teeth in that list. We need it to operate a little bit more like a private sector formulary. the managed care plans have formularies in place, and they tend to be more effective in cost savings than a voluntary system. We need more classes of drugs to be evaluated and made a part of our drug list. We need less exclusions of classes of drugs from that drug list. We need enhanced ability to use the prior authorization system if necessary for cost containment reasons. And finally, I would say that we need to build on something that Lynn just mentioned, and that is the supplemental rebates over and above what the federal government negotiates for us as Medicaid rebates. There's been quite a bit of interest recently, not just in Oregon, but by other states, and even some interest in states working together and using the ability of multi-state cooperation to get a little bit of increased leverage in working with drug manufacturers to get supplemental rebates. And we don't want to give up the 18% rebates that the federal government has negotiated for us. And that is a danger if we went down some of the roads that have been proposed as ways of saving money. We don't want to give up those rebates. We want to build on them. We want to get additional rebates and additional savings on top of our federally mandated Medicaid rebate program. And with that, I will turn it over to Lynn.
Thank you. Given the amount of time, I'll talk probably at a fairly high level. Many of the constraints that govern how we administer our program, Jim has really talked about within the context of the drug portion of our program, but they're similar constraints for the entire program. You know, at the high level, we have federal constraints. Since it's important to Oregon to draw down federal dollars into the Medicaid program, we have to abide by the rules of the federal program. For every dollar we spend in Oregon in Medicaid, about 40 cents is state dollars, 60 cents is federal dollars. And in the Children's Health Insurance Program, it's a higher return, 28 cents state money, 72 cents federal money. So it's important to bring in those dollars to operate the program whatever we can afford to put forward for our state match, and then to make sure we get the federal enhancement. Some of the rules that govern a federal Medicaid program, your program has to be statewide. We can't offer a service, a prescription drug benefit, in one part of the state and not offer it in another. The benefits have to be comparable for individuals participating in the program, although they do allow a little difference, for example, between the medically needy program and your regular Medicaid program. You have to allow clients freedom of choice to go to any provider who would accept their medical ID. Now, all of these are the traditional constraints in the program. Many of them you can get waivers from, and we have done that under the Oregon Health Plan. You cannot discriminate on the basis of a person's condition under a Medicaid program, although some might say that the way our prioritized list works, that we cover treatments for some conditions and not for others. And once again, we have a waiver that allows us to do that. But waivers come with strings attached as well. They don't allow us, for example, without federal approval, to make certain changes to our program. One of the things I've heard and talked about was, this is kind of before the Oregon Health Plan was, why don't we just establish a different limit in terms of who we cover? Perhaps we wouldn't cover those new eligibles, the portion of the 100,000 eligibles who don't have children in the household. Although you're not required to cover those people in a traditional Medicaid program, we have waivers that allow us to do that, and our waivers wouldn't let us just to say we're not going to cover those individuals anymore as a unilateral state decision. Instead, we'd have to go back to the federal government to get an amendment if that's what we wanted to do. I'm not suggesting that that's what we want to do. Clearly, you're seeing what some of the implications are as we're looking at reducing benefits for that population. Our own state statutes put constraints on how we operate the program. You know, some Jim has talked about when he was talking about the drug program. Other examples would be that we reimburse type A and B hospitals at cost. That's in statute. One of the reduction items that was listed in House as a result of House Bill 5100 is that we were going to change the reimbursement to those hospitals and have them move to the same kind of reimbursement that larger hospitals have. Now, in order to implement that reduction, and the money is gone from our budget, we don't have money to make those cost-based payments, we need a statutory change. And that bill hasn't moved forward, may not move forward. So there are those kind of constraints that are put in statute for appropriate reasons, and those are things that can be looked at over time. And going beyond that, maybe just want to talk a little bit, although I know you've spent some time with it, is that, you know, with the budgetary shortfalls, of course, there are really hard choices that the state is faced with. And many of those choices you've been faced with as legislators in the various special sessions when we come into an emergency board and rebalances. And some of those choices the agency has had to make, where instead the choices have been to do allotments, not identify what the reductions would be, and the agency has looked at where they could make their reductions. And that's been very difficult. You know, in our case, as I was saying, about 98% of our budget goes out as payments to the providers, managed care plans. And that doesn't leave us with many choices when it comes to making, as we are right now, a reduction in our budget of approximately 20% in the last 4 to 5 months of the biennium. We're really turning to looking at who's covered, what benefits they're covered for, and provider reimbursement, how much we're going to pay for those benefits. We do always look to efficiencies in the program. We have continually looked to what is it we could do differently. Generally, however, I have to say that a lot of the efficiencies, even the analysis, looking for ways to do business better, require a significant amount of staff resources to explore what's out there. To make sure that the programs we're putting in place are reasonable and appropriate for the clients that we serve. They require information system support. With our very old information system that we're in the process of replacing, it's very difficult to get some of those changes put in place. And they require a lot of changes our managed care plans also are impacted, and as they look to try and implement the reductions that are going on. You know, it's really a situation, I heard one of the managed care plans say today, that we're in a period of significant social change right now in Oregon, and we are. These kind of reductions are just changing what it is we do, what the state does for the people of Oregon. Of course, we look to you as you look to us for support in executing these choices that have been made. There are lots of pressures in terms of not moving forward with a particular reduction, and for legitimate reasons. We serve vulnerable populations in the program. At the same time, given the budget shortfalls, if we don't make a particular reduction, we have to find another one. And as we get closer and closer to the end of the biennium, the actions become more severe because there's less time to realize that savings. There are several bills that will be working their way through the session. I mentioned the type A and B hospital bill that's needed for if we are to realize that savings this biennium. But all of the reductions that have been put in place for this biennium or in the process of being put in place carry forward to the next biennium in the governor's balanced budget.
Yeah. Now, I do have a list here of hospitals. I don't know if you type A B hospital reimbursements is on the list. Presumptive eligibility, drug reimbursement cuts. on Friday, which is tomorrow, I know that the caucuses will have a meeting tomorrow morning, and we will be discussing priorities on further cuts. I don't know the details of that, but I know that what we might be talking about tomorrow afternoon at this time may not be the same as we're talking about right now, and so I think things are happening as we speak. And so you're giving us a kind of a snapshot, I guess, of where we are. And I would like to continue this conversation at some point as we go down the road, because we will need to work out where we want to go, and we could use your suggestions, and we might give some guidance. Are there other things that you want to do today?
You know, at this point, I would just say that as you look to the future, that one of the things that there are obviously your committee and four other committees that I know of are working on issues related to health care. There was a mention of Representative Westland's committee and the work that's going on there and the stakeholder groups, and relooking at what it is, where our priorities are within the available revenue. And that, you know, in limited resource time as you look to the future, you know, as much as possible looking at where you can get the biggest bang for the buck, where you can buy health, which isn't always health insurance, you know, looking to the safety net clinics out there as perhaps a viable adjunct to how we provide coverage today. And with that, we can. I'd be glad to close and address things in the future.
Won't let you close, Senator.
Well, Lynn, I can't miss the opportunity. You're the finance guru, aren't you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, at one point in time, I did have the OMAT budget unit reporting to me.
Can you explain to me the Medicaid upper limit issue and how that is accomplished and the calculations that go into that, and how it is that we either receive additional money or do not receive additional money, and what the future of that income source might
be? Right.
We don't use it for what we're supposed to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, I am not the financial guru as it relates to the Medicare upper payment limit. We need to bring in someone from program and finance office within the department. A lot of that leveraging that happened in that program is done through the nursing homes, which aren't a part of the OMAP program. And probably Margie Johnson would be the appropriate person to start with in terms of understanding how that works. If you want us to carry back a message or to get some information sent to you in writing,
I'd kind of like to know who's responsible and who has been responsible for those calculations, and
okay,
what the current status of those calculations might be, and so forth.
We will do that.
Thank you.
So you were giving us your closing remarks.
Well, you know, I just wanted to say that, you know, since I was talking at a very high level here, having spent our time on the pharmacy program, you know, all of their each portion is very complex in the Medicaid program, that there are cost drivers out there in the general healthcare marketplace that drive the costs in our program. Generally, we are responding to those outside influences just as the private sector is, and you know, we're looking for solutions along with the private sector in terms of containing costs, spending our dollars where we get the best value for it. In general, what I am hoping comes out of the process as you work through looking at how the state ought to reconfigure the Medicaid, the Oregon Health Plan components of our program, that process really starts from a framework of What is the base? Where are our priorities? How do we build up a program that we can live with that's sustainable into the future? And that, you know, there's both, first we've got to get through this biennium. There are those issues that we're dealing with. Then building the budget for 03-05, but eventually the economy will rebound. Hopefully we've, out of this process, laid a foundation that we can then build upon in the future, but that has the ability to ebb and flow with the economy that can be sustained into the future.
One of the things that I guess I would like to see from the stakeholders is, you know, their plan, their suggestion, and so on, because we need to have something to respond to. And if everybody's trying to build from scratch, that's not necessarily the best way to go. But if, you know, people from the various stakeholder groups come in and lay things out, to me that would be one of the better ways, and then to pick and choose and try to put something together. But and that's probably happening, hopefully.
It is happening, yeah. Mr. Chair. As a part of that process right now, that it will ultimately, I believe, feed into your committee, mm-hmm. as well as Representative Westland's committee, yeah. Representative Cruz's committee, and Senator Fisher's are reaching out to stakeholders to say, how is it we can do business differently? And what is it you can do to contribute to a more efficient and effective system?
Well, they would probably ask us what we could do to contribute to keeping them in the program.
But I do believe that folks are really looking at this seriously, recognizing that the money isn't there,
yeah.
And that we need to set those priorities and make our choices.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the meeting. Thank you very much. You do well under fire.